Chapter 17. Annette. The troubles of the future, however, soon faded before the troubles of the present, and of these the most immediate and pressing was that of hunger. Tommy had a healthy and vigorous appetite. The steak and chips partaken of for lunch seemed now to belong to another decade. He regretfully recognized the fact that he would not make a success of a hunger strike. He prowled aimlessly about his prison. Once or twice he discarded dignity and pounded on the door, but nobody answered the summons. "Hang it all!" said Tommy indignantly. "They can't mean to starve me to death!" A newborn fear passed through his mind that this might, perhaps, be one of those pretty ways of making a prisoner speak which had been attributed to Boris. But on reflection he dismissed the idea. "It's that sour-faced brute Conrad," he decided. "That's a fellow I shall enjoy getting even with one of these days. This is just a bit of spite on his part, I'm certain of it." Further meditations induced in him the feeling that it would be extremely pleasant to bring something down with a whack on Conrad's egg-shaped head. Tommy stroked his own head tenderly and gave himself up to the pleasures of imagination. Finally, a bright idea flashed across his brain. Why not convert imagination into reality? Conrad was undoubtedly the tenant of the house. The others, with the possible exception of the bearded German, merely used it as a rendezvous. Therefore, why not wait in ambush for Conrad behind the door, and when he entered, bring down a chair or one of the decrepit pictures smartly onto his head? One would, of course, be careful not to hit too hard, and then simply walk out. If he met anyone on the way down, well, Tommy brightened at the thought of an encounter with his fists. Such an affair was infinitely more in his line than the verbal encounter of this afternoon. Intoxicated by his plan, Tommy gently unhooked the picture of the devil and Faust and settled himself in position. His hopes were high. The plan seemed to him simple but excellent. Time went on, but Conrad did not appear. Night and day were the same in this prison room, but Tommy's wristwatch, which enjoyed a certain degree of accuracy, informed him that it was 9 o'clock in the evening. Tommy reflected gloomily that if supper did not arrive soon, it would be a question of waiting for breakfast. At 10 o'clock, hope deserted him, and he flung himself on the bed to seek consolation in sleep. In 5 minutes, his woes were forgotten. The sound of the key turning in the lock awoke him from his slumbers. Not belonging to the type of hero who is famous for awakening in full possession of his faculties, Tommy merely blinked at the ceiling and wondered vaguely where he was. Then he remembered and looked at his watch. It was 8 o'clock. "It's either early morning tea or breakfast," deduced the young man, "and pray God it's the latter." The door swung open. Too late, Tommy remembered his scheme of obliterating the unprepossessing Conrad. A moment later he was glad that he had, for it was not Conrad who entered, but a girl. She carried a tray, which she set down on the table. In the feeble light of the gas burner, Tommy blinked at her. He decided at once that she was one of the most beautiful girls he had ever seen. Her hair was a full, rich brown, with sudden glints of gold in it, as though there were imprisoned sunbeams struggling in its depths. There was a wild rose quality about her face. Her eyes, set wide apart, were hazel, a golden hazel, that again recalled a memory of sunbeams. A delirious thought shot through Tommy's mind. "Are you Jane Finn?" he asked breathlessly. The girl shook her head wonderingly. "My name is Annette, monsieur." She spoke in a soft, broken English. "Oh," said Tommy, rather taken aback. "Française?" he hazarded. "Oui, monsieur. Monsieur parle français?" "Not for any length of time," said Tommy. "What's that, breakfast?" The girl nodded. Tommy dropped off the bed and came and inspected the contents of the tray. It consisted of a loaf, some margarine, and a jug of coffee. "The living is not equal to the wits," he observed with a sigh, "but for what we are at last about to receive, the Lord has made me truly thankful. Amen." He drew up a chair, and the girl turned away to the door. "Wait a sec," cried Tommy. "There are lots of things I want to ask you, Annette. What are you doing in this house? Don't tell me you're Conrad's niece or daughter or anything, because I can't believe it. "'I do the service, monsieur. I am not related to anybody.'
"'I see,' said Tommy. "'You know what I asked you just now? Have you ever heard that name?'
"'I have heard people speak of Jane Finn, I think.'
"'You don't know where she is?' Annette shook her head. "'She's not in this house, for instance?'
"'Oh, no, monsieur. I must go now. They will be waiting for me.'
She hurried out. The key turned in the lock. "'I wonder who they are,' mused Tommy, as he continued to make inroads on the loaf. "'With a bit of luck, that girl might help me to get out of here. She doesn't look like one of the gang.' At 1 o'clock, Annette reappeared with another tray, but this time Conrad accompanied her. "'Good morning,' said Tommy amiably. "'You have not used Pear's soap, I see.' Conrad growled threateningly. "'No light repartee, have you, old bean? There, there, we can't always have brains as well as beauty. What have we for lunch? Stew? How did I know? Elementary, my dear Watson, the smell of onions is unmistakable.' "'Talk away,' grunted the man. "'It's little enough time you'll have to talk in, maybe.'
The remark was unpleasant in its suggestion, but Tommy ignored it. He sat down at the table.
"'Retire, varlet,' he said with a wave of his hand. "'Prate not to thy betters.'
That evening Tommy sat on the bed and cogitated deeply. Would Conrad again accompany the girl? If he did not, should he risk trying to make an ally of her? He decided that he must leave no stone unturned. His position was desperate. At 8 o'clock the familiar sound of the key turning made him spring to his feet. The girl was alone.
"'Shut the door,' he commanded. "'I want to speak to you.'
She obeyed.
"'Look here, Annette, I want you to help me get out of this.'
She shook her head.
"'Impossible. There are three of them on the floor below.'
"'Oh!' Tommy was secretly grateful for the information. "'But you would help me if you could.'
"'No, monsieur.'
"'Why not?'
The girl hesitated.
"'I think they are my own people. You have spied upon them. They are quite right to keep you here.'
"'They're a bad lot, Annette. If you'll help me, I'll take you away from the lot of them, and you'd probably get a good whack of money.'
But the girl merely shook her head.
"'I dare not, monsieur. I am afraid of them.'
She turned away.
"'Wouldn't you do anything to help another girl?' cried Tommy. "'She's about your age, too. Won't you save her from their clutches?'
"'You mean Jane Finn?'
"'Yes.'
"'It is her you came here to look for, yes?'
"'That's it.'
The girl looked at him, then passed her hand across her forehead.
"'Jane Finn, always I hear that name. It is familiar.'
Tommy came forward eagerly.
"'You must know something about her.'
But the girl turned away abruptly.
"'I know nothing, only the name.'
She walked towards the door. Suddenly she uttered a cry. Tommy stared. She had caught sight of the picture he had laid against the wall the night before. For a moment he caught a look of terror in her eyes. As inexplicably it changed to relief. Then abruptly she went out of the room. Tommy could make nothing of it. Did she fancy that he had meant to attack her with it? Surely not. He rehung the picture on the wall thoughtfully. 3 more days went by in dreary inaction. Tommy felt the strain telling on his nerves. He saw no one but Conrad and Annette, and the girl had become dumb. She spoke only in monosyllables. A kind of dark suspicion smouldered in her eyes. Tommy felt that if this solitary confinement went on much longer, he would go mad. He gathered from Conrad that they were waiting for orders from Mr. Brown. Perhaps, thought Tommy, he was abroad or away, and they were obliged to wait for his return. But the evening of the third day brought a rude awakening. It was barely 7 o'clock when he heard the tramp of footsteps outside in the passage. In another minute the door was flung open. Conrad entered. With him was the evil-looking No. 14. Tommy's heart sank at the sight of them.
"'Evening, guv'nor,' said the man with a leer. "'Got those ropes, mate?'
The silent Conrad produced a length of fine cord. The next minute No. 14's hands, horribly dexterous, were winding the cord round his limbs while Conrad held him down.
"'What the devil?' began Tommy.
But the slow, speechless grin of the silent Conrad froze the words on his lips. Number 14 proceeded deftly with his task. In another minute, Tommy was a mere helpless bundle. Then at last Conrad spoke.
"Thought you bluffed us, did you? With what you knew and what you didn't know, bargain with us. And all the time it was bluff, bluff. You know less than a kitten. But your number's up now, all right, you bee-swine."
Tommy lay silent. There was nothing to say. He had failed. Somehow or other, the omnipotent Mr. Brown had seen through his pretensions. Suddenly, a thought occurred to him.
"A very good speech, Conrad," he said approvingly. "But wherefore the bonds and fetters, Why not let this kind gentleman here cut my throat without delay?"
"Garn," said Number 14 unexpectedly.
"Think we're as green as to do you in here and have the police nosing round? Not off. We've ordered the carriage for your lordship tomorrow morning, but in the meantime we're not taking any chances, see?"
Nothing, said Tommy, could be plainer than your words, unless it was your face.
"Stow it," said Number 14.
"With pleasure," replied Tommy. "You're making a sad mistake, but yours will be the loss."
"You don't kid us that way again," said Number 14, "talking as though you were still at the blooming Ritz, aren't you?"
Tommy made no reply. He was engaged in wondering how Mr. Brown had discovered his identity. He decided that Tuppence, in the throes of anxiety, had gone to the police, and that his disappearance having been made public, the gang had not been slow to put two and two together. The two men departed, and the door slammed. Tommy was left to his meditations. They were not pleasant ones. Already his limbs felt cramped and stiff. He was utterly helpless, and he could see no hope anywhere. About an hour had passed when he heard the key softly turned and the door opened. It was Annette. Tommy's heart beat a little faster. He had forgotten the girl. Was it possible that she had come to his help? Suddenly he heard Conrad's voice.
"Come out of it, Annette. He doesn't want any supper tonight."
"Oui, oui, je sais bien, but I must take the other tray. We need the things on it."
"Well, hurry up,"
growled Conrad. Without looking at Tommy, the girl went over to the table and picked up the tray. She raised a hand and turned out the light.
"Curse you!"
Conrad had come to the door.
"Why did you do that?"
"I always turn it out. You should have told me. Shall I relight it, Monsieur Conrad?"
"No, come on out of it."
"Le beau petit monsieur,"
cried Annette, pausing by the bed in the darkness.
"You have tied him up well, bien. He's like a trussed chicken."
The frank amusement in her tone jarred on the boy, but at that moment, to his amazement, he felt her hand running lightly over his bonds, and something small and cold was pressed into the palm of his hand.
"Come on, Annette."
"Mais me voilà."
The door shut. Tommy heard Conrad say,
"Lock it and give me the key."
The footsteps died away. Tommy lay petrified with amazement. The object Annette had thrust into his hand was a small penknife, the blade open. From the way she had studiously avoided looking at him, and her action with the light, he came to the conclusion that the room was overlooked. There must be a peephole somewhere in the walls. Remembering how guarded she had always been in her manner, he saw that he had probably been under observation all the time. Had he said anything to give himself away? Hardly. He had revealed a wish to escape and a desire to find Jane Finn, but nothing that could have given a clue to his own identity. True, his question to Annette had proved that he was personally unacquainted with Jane Finn, but he had never pretended otherwise. The question now was, did Annette really know more? Were her denials intended primarily for the listeners? On that point he could come to no conclusion. But there was a more vital question that drove out all others. Could he, bound as he was, manage to cut his bonds? He essayed cautiously to rub the open blade up and down on the cord that bound his two wrists together. It was an awkward business, and drew a smothered "ow" of pain from him as the knife cut into his wrist. But slowly and doggedly he went on, sawing to and fro. He cut the flesh badly, but at last he felt the cord slacken. With his hands free, the rest was easy. 5 minutes later he stood upright with some difficulty owing to the cramp in his limbs. His first care was to bind up his bleeding wrist. Then he sat on the edge of the bed to think. Conrad had taken the key of the door, so he could expect little more assistance from Annette. The only outlet from the room was the door. Consequently, he would perforce have to wait until the two men returned to fetch him. But when they did, Tommy smiled. Moving with infinite caution in the dark room, he found and unhooked the famous picture. He felt an economical pleasure that his first plan would not be wasted. There was now nothing to do but to wait. He waited. The night passed slowly. Tommy lived through an eternity of hours, but at last he heard footsteps. He stood upright, drew a deep breath, and clutched the picture firmly. The door opened. A faint light streamed in from outside. Conrad went straight towards the gas to light it. Tommy deeply regretted that it was he who had entered first. It would have been pleasant to get even with Conrad. Number 14 followed. As he stepped across the threshold, Tommy brought the picture down with terrific force on his head. Number 14 went down amidst a stupendous crash of broken glass. In a minute, Tommy had slipped out and pulled to the door. The key was in the lock. He turned it and withdrew it, just as Conrad hurled himself against the door from the inside with a volley of curses. For a moment, Tommy hesitated. There was the sound of someone stirring on the floor below. Then the German's voice came up the stairs.
"Gott in Himmel! Conrad, what is it?"
Tommy felt a small hand thrust into his. Beside him stood Annette. She pointed up a rickety ladder that apparently led to some attics. "Quick, up here!" She dragged him after her up the ladder. In another moment they were standing in a dusty garret littered with lumber. Tommy looked round. "This won't do. It's a regular trap. There's no way out."
"Hush! Wait!"
The girl put her finger to her lips. She crept to the top of the ladder and listened. The banging and beating on the door was terrific. The German and another were trying to force the door in. Annette explained in a whisper,
"They will think you are still inside. They cannot hear what Conrad says. The door is too thick."
"I thought you could hear what went on in the room."
"There is a peephole into the next room. It was clever of you to guess. But they will not think of that. They are only anxious to get in."
"Yes, but look here."
"Leave it to me."
She bent down. To his amazement, Tommy saw that she was fastening the end of a long piece of string to the handle of a big, cracked jug. She arranged it carefully, then turned to Tommy.
"Have you the key of the door?"
"Yes."
"Give it to me."
He handed it to her.
"I am going down. Do you think you can go halfway and then swing yourself down behind the ladder so that they will not see you?"
Tommy nodded.
"There's a big cupboard in the shadow of the landing. Stand behind it. Take the end of this string in your hand. When I've let the others out, pull."
Before he had time to ask her anything more, she had flitted lightly down the ladder and was in the midst of the group with a loud cry.
"Mon Dieu! Mon Dieu! Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?"
The German turned on her with an oath.
"Get out of this! Go to your room!"
Very cautiously, Tommy swung himself down the back of the ladder. So long as they did not turn round, all was well. He crouched behind the cupboard. They were still between him and the stairs.
"Ah!"
Annette appeared to stumble over something. She stooped.
"Mon Dieu! Voilà la clé!"
The German snatched it from her. He unlocked the door. Conrad stumbled out, swearing.
"Where is he? Have you got him?"
"We have seen no one," said the German sharply.
His face paled.
"What do you mean?"
Conrad gave vent to another oath.
"He's got away."
"Impossible. He would have passed us."
At that moment, with an ecstatic smile, Tommy pulled the string. A crash of crockery came from the attic above. In a trice, the men were pushing each other up the rickety ladder and had disappeared into the darkness above. Quick as a flash, Tommy leapt from his hiding place and dashed down the stairs, pulling the girl with him. There was no one in the hall. He fumbled over the bolts and chain. At last they yielded. The door swung open. He turned. Annette had disappeared. Tommy stood spellbound. Had she run upstairs again? What madness possessed her? He fumed with impatience, but he stood his ground. He would not go without her. And suddenly there was an outcry overhead, an exclamation from the German, and then Annette's voice
clear and high.
Ma foi, he has escaped, and quickly, who would have thought it?
Tommy still stood rooted to the ground. Was that a command for him to go? He fancied it was. And then, louder still, the words floated down to him.
This is a terrible house. I want to go back to Marguerite. To Marguerite. To Marguerite.
Tommy had run back to the stairs. She wanted him to go and leave her, but why? At all costs, he must try and get her away with him. Then his heart sank. Conrad was leaping down the stairs, uttering a savage cry at the sight of him. After him came the others. Tommy stopped Conrad's rush with a straight blow with his fist. It caught the other man on the point of the jaw, and he fell like a log. The second man tripped over his body and fell. From higher up the staircase there was a flash, and a bullet grazed Tommy's ear. He realized that it would be good for his health to get out of this house as soon as possible. As regards Annette, he could do nothing. He had got even with Conrad, which was one satisfaction. The blow had been a good one. He leapt for the door, slamming it behind him. The square was deserted. In front of the house was a baker's van. Evidently he was to have been taken out of London in that, and his body found many miles from the house in Soho. The driver jumped to the pavement and tried to bar Tommy's way. Again Tommy's fist shot out, and the driver sprawled on the pavement. Tommy took to his heels and ran, none too soon. The front door opened, and a hail of bullets followed him. Fortunately, none of them hit him. He turned the corner of the square. "There's one thing," he thought to himself. "They can't go on shooting. They'll have the police after them if they do. I wonder they dared to there." He heard the footsteps of his pursuers behind him and redoubled his own pace. Once he got out of these byways, he would be safe. There would be a policeman about somewhere. Not that he really wanted to invoke the aid of the police, if he could possibly do without it. It meant explanations and general awkwardness. In another moment he had reason to bless his luck. He stumbled over a prostrate figure, which started up with a yell of alarm and dashed off down the street. Tommy drew back into a doorway. In a minute he had the pleasure of seeing his two pursuers, of whom the German was one, industriously tracking down the red herring. Tommy sat down quietly on the doorstep and allowed a few moments to elapse while he recovered his breath. Then he strolled gently in the opposite direction. He glanced at his watch. It was a little after 5:30. It was rapidly growing light. At the next corner he passed a policeman. The policeman cast a suspicious eye on him. Tommy felt slightly offended. Then, passing his hand over his face, he laughed. He had not shaved or washed for 3 days. What a guy he must look! He betook himself without more ado to a Turkish bath establishment, which he knew to be open all night. He emerged into the busy daylight, feeling himself once more, and able to make plans. First of all, he must have a square meal. He had eaten nothing since midday yesterday. He turned into an ABC shop and ordered eggs and bacon and coffee. Whilst he ate, he read a morning paper propped up in front of him. Suddenly he stiffened. There was a long article on Kramenin, who was described as the man behind Bolshevism in Russia, and who had just arrived in London, some thought, as an unofficial envoy. His career was sketched lightly, and it was firmly asserted that he, and not the figurehead leaders, had been the author of the Russian Revolution. In the centre of the page was his portrait. "So that's who number one is," said Tommy, with his mouth full of eggs and bacon. "Not a doubt about it. I must push on." He paid for his breakfast and betook himself to Whitehall. There he sent up his name and the message that it was urgent. A few minutes later he was in the presence of the man who did not here go by the name of Mr. Carter. There was a frown on his face. "Look here, you're no business to come asking for me in this way. I thought that was distinctly understood." "It was, sir, but I judged it important to lose no time." And as briefly and succinctly as possible, he detailed the experiences of the last few days. Halfway through, Mr. Carter interrupted him to give a few cryptic orders through the telephone. All traces of displeasure had now left his face. He nodded energetically when Tommy had finished. "Quite right. Every moment's of value. Fear we shall be too late anyway. They wouldn't wait. Would clear out at once. Still, they may have left something behind them that will be a clue. You say you've recognised number one to be Kremenin? That's important. We want something against him badly to prevent the cabinet falling on his neck too freely. What about the others? You say two faces were familiar to you? One's a Labour man, you think? Just look through these photos and see if you can spot him. A minute later, Tommy held one up. Mr. Carter exhibited some surprise. Ah, Westway. Shouldn't have thought it. Poses as being moderate. As for the other fellow, I think I can give a good guess. He handed another photograph to Tommy and smiled at the other's exclamation. I'm right, then. Who is he? Irishman? Prominent Unionist MP. All a blind, of course. We've suspected it, but couldn't get any proofs. Yes, you've done very well, young man. The 29th, you say, is the date. That gives us very little time. Very little time indeed. But Tommy hesitated. Mr. Carter read his thoughts. We can deal with the general strike menace, I think. It's a toss-up, but we've got a sporting chance. But if that draft treaty turns up, we're done. England will be plunged into anarchy. Ah, what's that, the car? Come on, Beresford, we'll go and have a look at this house of yours. Two constables were on duty in front of the house in Soho. An inspector reported to Mr. Carter in a low voice. The latter turned to Tommy. The birds have flown, as we thought. We might as well go over it. Going over the deserted house seemed to Tommy to partake of the character of a dream. Everything was just as it had been. The prison room with the crooked pictures, the broken jug in the attic, the meeting room with its long table. But nowhere was there a trace of papers. Everything of that kind had either been destroyed or taken away, and there was no sign of Annette. "What you tell me about the girl puzzled me," said Mr. Carter. "You believe that she deliberately went back?" "It would seem so, sir. She ran upstairs while I was getting the door open." She must belong to the gang, then. But being a woman didn't feel like standing by to see a personable young man killed. But evidently she is in with them, or she wouldn't have gone back. I can't believe she's really one of them, sir. She seemed so different. Good-looking, I suppose, said Mr. Carter, with a smile that made Tommy flush to the roots of his hair. He admitted Annette's beauty rather shamefacedly. By the way, observed Mr. Carter, have you shown yourself to Miss Tuppence yet? She's been bombarding me with letters about you. Tuppence, I was afraid she might get a bit rattled. Did she go to the police? Mr. Carter shook his head. Then I wonder how they twigged me. Mr. Carter looked inquiringly at him, and Tommy explained. The other nodded thoughtfully. True. That's rather a curious point, unless the mention of the writs was an accidental remark. It might have been, sir, but they must have found out about me suddenly in some way. Well, said Mr. Carter, looking round him, there's nothing more to be done here. What about some lunch with me? "'Thanks awfully, sir, but I think I'd better get back and rout out Tuppence. "'Of course. Give her my kind regards, and tell her not to believe you're killed too readily next time.' Tommy grinned. "'I take a lot of killing, sir.' "'So I perceive,' said Mr. Carter dryly. "'Well, good-bye. Remember, you're a marked man now, and take reasonable care of yourself. Thank you, sir.' Hailing a taxi briskly, Tommy stepped in and was swiftly borne to the Ritz, dwelling the while on the pleasurable anticipation of startling Tuppence. "'Wonder what she's been up to. Dogging Rita, most likely. By the way, I suppose that's who Annette meant by Marguerite. I didn't get it at the time.' The thought saddened him a little, for it seemed to prove that Mrs. Vandermeer and the girl were on intimate terms. The taxi drew up at the Ritz. Tommy burst into its sacred portals eagerly, but his enthusiasm received a check. He was informed that Miss Cowley had gone out a quarter of an hour ago. Chapter 18. The Telegram. Baffled for the moment, Tommy strolled into the restaurant and ordered a meal of surpassing excellence. His 4 days' imprisonment had taught him anew to value good food. He was in the middle of conveying a particularly choice morsel of sole à la Jeannette to his mouth
when he caught sight of Julius entering the room. Tommy waved a menu cheerfully and succeeded in attracting the other's attention. At the sight of Tommy, Julius's eyes seemed as though they would pop out of his head. He strode across and pump-handled Tommy's hand with what seemed to the latter quite unnecessary vigour.
"Holy snakes!" he ejaculated. "Is it really you?" "Of course it is. Why shouldn't it be?" "Why shouldn't it be? Say, man, don't you know you've been given up for dead? I guess we'd have had a solemn requiem for you in another few days."
"Who thought I was dead?" demanded Tommy.
"Tuppence!
Do you remember the proverb about the good dying young, I suppose? There must be a certain amount of original sin in me to have survived. Where is Tuppence, by the way? Isn't she here?"
"No, the fellows at the office said she'd just gone out."
"Gone shopping, I guess. I dropped her here in the car about an hour ago. But say, can't you shed that British calm of yours and get down to it? What on God's earth have you been doing all this time?"
"If you're feeding here," replied Tommy, "order now. It's going to be a long story."
Julius drew up a chair to the opposite side of the table, summoned a hovering waiter, and dictated his wishes. Then he turned to Tommy.
"Fire ahead. I guess you've had some few adventures."
"One or two," replied Tommy modestly, and plunged into his recital.
Julius listened, spellbound. Half the dishes that were placed before him he forgot to eat. At the end he heaved a long sigh.
"Bully for you! Reads like a dime novel."
"And now for the home front," said Tommy, stretching out his hand for a peach.
"Well," drawled Julius, "I don't mind admitting we've had some adventures too."
He, in his turn, assumed the role of narrator. Beginning with his unsuccessful reconnoitering at Bournemouth, he passed on to his return to London, the buying of the car, the growing anxieties of Tuppence, the call upon Sir James, and the sensational occurrences of the previous night.
"But who killed her?" asked Tommy. "I don't quite understand."
"The doctor kidded himself she took it herself," replied Julius dryly.
"And Sir James, what did he think?"
"Being a legal luminary, he is likewise a human oyster," replied Julius. "I should say he reserved judgment."
He went on to detail the events of the morning.
"Lost her memory, eh?" said Tommy with interest. "By Jove, that explains why they looked at me so queerly when I spoke of questioning her. Bit of a slip on my part, that. But it wasn't the sort of thing a fellow would be likely to guess."
"They, didn't give you any sort of hint as to where Jane was?"
Tommy shook his head regretfully.
"Not a word. I'm a bit of an ass, as you know. I ought to have got more out of them somehow." "I guess you're lucky to be here at all. That bluff of yours was the goods all right. How you ever came to think of it all so pat beats me to a frazzle."
"I was in such a funk I had to think of something," said Tommy simply.
There was a moment's pause, and then Tommy reverted to Mrs. Vandermeer's death.
"There's no doubt it was chloral." "I believe not. At least they call it heart failure induced by an overdose or some such claptrap. It's all right, we don't want to be worried with an inquest. But I guess Tuppence and I, and even the highbrow Sir James, have all got the same idea."
"Mr. Brown?" hazarded Tommy.
"Sure thing."
Tommy nodded.
"All the same," he said thoughtfully, "Mr. Brown hasn't got wings. I don't see how he got in and out."
"How about some high-class thought transference stunt? Some magnetic influence that irresistibly impelled Mrs. Vandermeer to commit suicide?"
Tommy looked at him with respect.
"Good, Julius, distinctly good, especially the phraseology. But it leaves me cold. I yearn for a real Mr. Brown of flesh and blood. I think the gifted young detectives must get to work, study the entrances and exits, and tap the bumps on their foreheads until the solution of the mystery dawns on them. Let's go round to the scene of the crime. I wish we could get hold of Tuppence. The Ritz would enjoy the spectacle of the glad reunion."
The inquiry at the office revealed the fact that Tuppence had not yet returned.
"All the same, I guess I'll have a look round upstairs," said Julius. "She might be in my sitting room."
He disappeared. Suddenly, a diminutive boy spoke at Tommy's elbow.
"The young lady, she's gone away by train, I think, sir,"
he murmured shyly.
"What?"
Tommy wheeled round upon him. The small boy became pinker than before.
"The taxi, sir. I heard her tell the driver Charing Cross and to look sharp."
Tommy stared at him, his eyes opening wide in surprise. Emboldened, the small boy proceeded.
"So I thought, having asked for an ABC and a Bradshaw..."
Tommy interrupted him. "When did she ask for an ABC and a Bradshaw?"
"When I took her for telegram, sir."
"A telegram?"
"Yes, sir."
"When was that?"
"About 12:30, sir."
"Tell me exactly what happened." The small boy drew a long breath.
"I took up a telegram to number 891. The lady was there. She opened it and gave a gasp. And then she said very jolly-like, 'Bring me up a Bradshaw and an ABC and look sharp, Henry. My name isn't Henry, but—'"
"Never mind your name," said Tommy impatiently. "Go on."
"Yes, sir. I brought them, and she told me to wait and looked up something. And then she looks up at the clock and, 'Hurry up,' she says. 'Tell him to get me a taxi.' And she begins a-shoving on of her hat in front of the glass. And she was down in two ticks, almost as quick as I was. And I seed her going down the steps and into the taxi. And I heard her call out what I told you."
The small boy stopped and replenished his lungs. Tommy continued to stare at him. At that moment Julius rejoined him. He held an open letter in his hand.
"I say, Hersheimer," Tommy turned to him, "Tuppence has gone off sleuthing on her own."
"Shucks!"
"Yes, she has. She went off in a taxi to Charing Cross in the deuce of a hurry after getting a telegram."
His eye fell on the letter in Julius's hand.
"Oh, she left a note for you. That's all right. Where's she off to?"
Almost unconsciously he held out his hand for the letter, but Julius folded it up and placed it in his pocket. He seemed a trifle embarrassed.
I guess this is nothing to do with it. It's about something else, something I asked her that she was to let me know about."
"Oh?" Tommy looked puzzled and seemed waiting for more.
"See here," said Julius suddenly, "I'd better put you wise. I asked Miss Tuppence to marry me this morning."
"Oh," said Tommy mechanically. He felt dazed. Julius's words were totally unexpected. For the moment they benumbed his brain.
"I'd like to tell you," continued Julius, "that before I suggested anything of the kind to Miss Tuppence, I made it clear that I didn't want to butt in any way between her and you."
Tommy roused himself.
"That's all right," he said quickly. "Tuppence and I have been pals for years. Nothing more."
He lit a cigarette with a hand that shook ever so little.
"That's quite all right. Tuppence always said that she was looking out for—"
He stopped abruptly, his face crimsoning, but Julius was in no way discomposed.
"Oh, I guess it'll be the dollars that'll do the trick. Miss Tuppence put me wise to that right away. There's no humbug about her. We ought to gee along together very well."
Tommy looked at him curiously for a minute, as though he were about to speak, then changed his mind and said nothing. Tuppence and Julius?
Well, why not? Had she not lamented the fact that she knew no rich men? Had she not openly avowed her intention of marrying for money if she ever had the chance? Her meeting with the young American millionaire had given her the chance, and it was unlikely she would be slow to avail herself of it. She was out for money, she had always said so. Why blame her because she had been true to her creed?
Nevertheless, Tommy did blame her. He was filled with a passionate and utterly illogical resentment.
It was all very well to say things like that, but a real girl would never marry for money. Tuppence was utterly cold-blooded and selfish, and he would be delighted if he never saw her again. And it was a rotten world.
Julius's voice broke in on these meditations.
"Yes, we ought to gee along together very well. I've heard that a girl always refuses you once, a sort of convention."
Tommy caught his arm.
"Refuses? Did you say refuses?" "Sure thing. Didn't I tell you that? She just rapped out a no without any kind of reason to it. The eternal feminine, the Huns call it, I've heard. But she'll come round right enough. Likely enough I hustled her some—"
But Tommy interrupted, regardless of decorum.
"What did she say in that note?" he demanded fiercely.
The obliging Julius handed it to him.
"There's no earthly clue in it as to where she's gone," he assured Tommy, "but you might as well see for yourself if you don't believe me."
The note, in Tuppence's well-known schoolboy writing, ran as followed. "Dear Julius, it's always better to have things in black and white. I don't feel I can be bothered to think of marriage until Tommy is found. Let's leave it till then. Yours affectionately, Tuppence."
Tommy handed it back, his eyes shining. His feelings had undergone a sharp reaction. He now felt that Tuppence was all that was noble and disinterested. Had she not refused Julius without hesitation? True, the note betokened signs of weakening, but he could excuse that. It read almost like a bribe to Julius to spur him on in his efforts to find Tommy. But he supposed she had not really meant it that way. Darling Tuppence, there was not a girl in the world to touch her. When he saw her... His thoughts were brought up with a sudden jerk.
"As you will say," he remarked, pulling himself together, "there's not a hint here as to what she's up to. Hi, Henry!"
The small boy came obediently. Tommy produced 5 shillings.
"One thing more. Do you remember what the young lady did with the telegram?"
Henry gasped and spoke.
"She crumpled it up into a ball and threw it into the grate and made a sort of noise like whoop, sir."
"Very graphic, Henry," said Tommy. "Here's your 5 shillings. Come on, Julius, we must find that telegram."
They hurried upstairs. Tuppence had left the key in her door. The room was as she had left it. In the fireplace was a crumpled ball of orange and white. Tommy disentangled it and smoothed out the telegram. "Come at once. Moat House, Ebury, Yorkshire. Great developments. Tommy." They looked at each other in stupefaction. Julia spoke first.
"You didn't send it?"
"Of course not. What does it mean?"
"I guess it means the worst," said Julius quietly. "They've got her."
"What?"
"Sure thing. They signed your name and she fell into the trap like a lamb."
"My God, what shall we do?"
"Get busy and go after her, right now. There's no time to waste. It's almighty luck that she didn't take the wire with her. If she had, we'd probably never have traced her. But we've got to hustle. Where's that Bradshaw?"
The energy of Julius was infectious. Left to himself, Tommy would probably have sat down to think things out for a good half hour before he decided on a plan of action. But with Julius Hirschheimer about, hustling was inevitable. After a few muttered imprecations, he handed the Bradshaw to Tommy as being more conversant with its mysteries. Tommy abandoned it in favour of an ABC.
"Here we are. Ebury, Yorks, from King's Cross or St. Pancras. Boy, I must have made a mistake. It was King's Cross, not Charing Cross. 12:50, that's the train she went by. 2:10, that's gone. 3:20 is the next, and a damned slow train, too.
What about the car?"
Tommy shook his head.
"Send it up if you like, but we'd better stick to the train. The great thing is to keep calm."
Julius groaned.
"That's so, but it gets my goat to think of that innocent young girl in danger."
Tommy nodded abstractedly. He was thinking. In a moment or two, he said,
"I say, Julius, what do they want her for, anyway?"
"Eh? I don't get you."
"What I mean is that I don't think it's their game to do her any harm," explained Tommy, puckering his brow with a strain of his mental processes. "She's a hostage, that's what she is. She's in no immediate danger, because if we tumble on to anything, she'd be damned useful to them. As long as they've got her, they've got the whip hand of us, see?"
"Sure thing," said Julius thoughtfully.
"That's so."
"Besides," added Tommy as an afterthought, "I've great faith in Tuppence."
The journey was wearisome, with many stops and crowded carriages. They had to change twice, once at Doncaster, once at a small junction. Ebury was a deserted station with a solitary porter, to whom Tommy addressed himself.
"Can you tell me the way to the Moat House?"
"The Moat House? It's a tidy step from here. The big house near the sea, you mean?"
Tommy assented brazenly. After listening to the porter's meticulous but perplexing directions, they prepared to leave the station. It was beginning to rain, and they turned up the collars of their coats as they trudged through the slush of the road. Suddenly Tommy halted.
"Wait a moment."
He ran back to the station and tackled the porter anew.
"Look here, do you remember a young lady who arrived by an earlier train at 12:50 from London? She'd probably ask you the way to the Moat House."
He described Tuppence as well as he could, but the porter shook his head. Several people had arrived by the train in question.
He could not call to mind one young lady in particular, but he was quite certain that no one had asked him the way to the Moat House.
Tommy rejoined Julius and explained. Depression was settling down on him like a leaden weight. He felt convinced that their quest was going to be unsuccessful. The enemy had over 3 hours' start. 3 hours was more than enough for Mr. Brown. He would not ignore the possibility of the telegram having been found. The way seemed endless. Once they took the wrong turning and went nearly half a mile out of their direction. It was past 7 o'clock when a small boy told them that the Moat House was just past the next corner. A rusty iron gate swinging dismally on its hinges, and overgrown drive thick with leaves. There was something about the place that struck a chill to both their hearts. They went up the deserted drive. The leaves deadened their footsteps. The daylight was almost gone. It was like walking in a world of ghosts. Overhead the branches flapped and creaked with a mournful note. Occasionally a sodden leaf drifted silently down, startling them with its cold touch on their cheek. A turn of the drive brought them in sight of the house. That, too, seemed empty and deserted. The shutters were closed, the steps up to the door overgrown with moss. Was it indeed to this desolate spot that Tuppence had been decoyed? It seemed hard to believe that a human footstep had passed this way for months. Julius jerked the rusty bell handle. A jangled peal rang discordantly, echoing through the emptiness within. No one came. They rang again and again, but there was no sign of life. Then they walked completely round the house. Everywhere, silence and shuttered windows. If they could believe the evidence of their eyes, the place was empty. "Nothing doing," said Julius. They retraced their steps slowly to the gate. "There must be a village handy," continued the young American. "We'd better make inquiries there. They'll know something about the place and whether there's been anyone there lately. Yes, that's not a bad idea." Proceeding up the road, they soon came to a little hamlet. On the outskirts of it, they met a workman swinging his bag of tools, and Tommy stopped him with a question. "The Moat House? It's empty. Been empty for years. Mrs. Sweeney's got the key if you want to go over it, next to the post office." Tommy thanked him. They soon found the post office, which was also a sweet and general fancy shop, and knocked at the door of the cottage next to it. A clean, wholesome-looking woman opened it. She readily produced the key of the Moat House. "Though I doubt if it's the kind of place to suit you, sir. In a terrible state of repair, ceilings leaking and all, 'twould need a lot of money spent on it." "Thanks," said Tommy cheerily. "I dare say it'll be a washout, but houses are scarce nowadays." "That they are," declared the woman heartily. "My daughter and son-in-law have been looking for a decent cottage for I don't know how long. It's all the war. Upset things terribly, it has." "But excuse me, sir, it'll be too dark for you to see much of the house. Hadn't you better wait until tomorrow?" "That's all right. We'll have a look around this evening, anyway. We'd have been here before, only we lost our way. What's the best place to stay at for the night round here?" Mrs. Sweeney looked doubtful. "There's the Yorkshire Arms, but it's not much of a place for gentlemen like you." "Oh, it will do very well. Thanks. By the way, you've not had a young lady here asking for this key today?" The woman shook her head. "Oh, no one's been over the place for a long time. Thanks very much." They retraced their steps to the Moat House. As the front door swung back on its hinges, protesting loudly, Julius struck a match and examined the floor carefully. Then he shook his head. "I'd swear no one's passed this way. Look at the dust, thick, not a sign of a footmark." They wandered round the deserted house. Everywhere the same tale, thick layers of dust, apparently undisturbed. "This gets me," said Julius. "I don't believe Tuppence was ever in this house." "She must have been." Julius shook his head without replying. "We'll go over it again tomorrow," said Tommy. "Perhaps we'll see more in the daylight." On the morrow they took up the search once more, and were reluctantly forced to the conclusion that the house had not been invaded for some considerable time. They might have left the village altogether, but for a fortunate discovery of Tommy's. As they were retracing their steps to the gate, he gave a sudden cry, and, stooping,
picked something up from among the leaves and held it out to Julius. It was a small gold brooch.
"That's Tuppence's."
"Are you sure?"
"Absolutely. I've often seen her wear it."
Julius drew a deep breath.
"I guess that settles it. She came as far as here, anyway. We'll make that pub our headquarters and raise hell round here until we find her. Somebody must have seen her."
Forthwith, the campaign began. Tommy and Julius worked separately and together, but the result was the same. Nobody answering to Tuppence's description had been seen in the vicinity. They were baffled, but not discouraged. Finally, they altered their tactics. Tuppence had certainly not remained long in the neighbourhood of the moat house. That pointed to her having been overcome and carried away in a car. They renewed inquiries. Had anyone seen a car standing somewhere near the moat house that day? Again, they met with no success. Julius wired to town for his own car, and they scoured the neighbourhood daily with unflagging zeal. A grey limousine, on which they had set high hopes, was traced to Harrogate and turned out to be the property of a highly respectable maiden lady. Each day saw them set out on a new quest. Julius was like a hound on the leash. He followed up the slenderest clue. Every car that had passed through the village on the fateful day was tracked down. He forced his way into country properties and submitted the owners of the motors to a searching cross-examination. His apologies were as thorough as his methods, and seldom failed in disarming the indignation of his victims. But as day succeeded day, they were no nearer to discovering Tuppence's whereabouts. So well had the abduction been planned that the girl seemed literally to have vanished into thin air. And another preoccupation was weighing on Tommy's mind.
"Do you know how long we've been here?" he asked one morning as they sat facing each other at breakfast. "A week! We're no nearer to finding Tuppence, and next Sunday is the 29th. "Shucks," said Julius thoughtfully. "I'd almost forgotten about the 29th. I've been thinking of nothing but Tuppence." "So have I. At least I hadn't forgotten about the 29th, but it didn't seem to matter a damn in comparison to finding Tuppence. But today's the 23rd, and time's getting short. If we're ever going to get hold of her at all, we must do it before the 29th. Her life won't be worth an hour's purchase afterwards. The hostage game will be played out by then. I'm beginning to feel that we've made a big mistake in the way we've set about this. We've wasted time, and we're no forrader. I'm with you there. We've been a couple of mutts who've bitten off a bigger bit than they can chew. I'm going to quit fooling right away."
"What do you mean?"
"I'll tell you. I'm going to do what we ought to have done a week ago. I'm going right back to London to put the case in the hands of your British police. We fancied ourselves as sleuths. Ha! Sleuths! That was a piece of damn fool foolishness. I'm through. I've had enough of it. Scotland Yard for me."
"You're right," said Tommy slowly. "I wish to God we'd gone there right away."
"Better late than never. We've been like a couple of babes playing here we go round the mulberry bush. Now I'm going right along to Scotland Yard to ask them to take me by the hand and show me the way I should go. I guess the professional always scores over the amateur in the end. Are you coming along with me?"
Tommy shook his head.
"What's the good? One of us is enough. I might as well stay here and nose round a bit longer. Something might turn up, one never knows."
"Sure thing.
Well, so long. I'll be back in a couple of shakes with a few inspectors along. I shall tell them to pick out their brightest and best."
But the course of events was not to follow the plan Julius had laid down. Later in the day, Tommy received a wire.
"Join me, Manchester, Midland Hotel, important news, Julius."
At 7:30 that night, Tommy alighted from a slow cross-country train. Julius was on the platform.
"Thought you'd come by this train if you weren't out when my wire arrived."
Tommy grasped him by the arm.
"What is it? Is Tuppence found?"
Julius shook his head.
"No, but I found this, waiting in London, just arrived."
He handed the telegraph form to the other. Tommy's eyes opened as he read, "Jane Finn found. Come Manchester Midland Hotel immediately. Peel Edgerton." Julius took the form back and folded it up.
"Queer," he said thoughtfully. "I thought that lawyer chap had quit."
Chapter 19. Jane Finn.
"My train got in half an hour ago,"
explained Julius as he led the way out of the station. "I reckoned you'd come by this before I left London, and wired accordingly to Sir James. He's booked rooms for us, and we'll be round to dine at 8.
"What made you think he'd cease to take any interest in the case?" asked Tommy curiously.
"What he said," replied Julius dryly. "The old bird's as close as an oyster. Like all the darned lot of them, he wasn't going to commit himself till he was sure he could deliver the goods."
"I wonder," said Tommy thoughtfully. Julius turned on him.
"You wonder what?"
"Whether that was his real reason."
"Sure, you bet your life it was."
Tommy shook his head, unconvinced. Sir James arrived punctually at 8 o'clock, and Julius introduced Tommy. Sir James shook hands with him warmly.
"I am delighted to make your acquaintance, Mr. Beresford. I've heard so much about you from Miss Tuppence."
He smiled involuntarily.
"But it really seems as though I already know you quite well."
"Thank you, sir," said Tommy with his cheerful grin. He scanned the great lawyer eagerly. Like Tuppence, he felt the magnetism of the other's personality. He was reminded of Mr. Carter. The two men, totally unalike so far as physical resemblance went, produced a similar effect. Beneath the weary manner of the one and the professional reserve of the other lay the same quality of mind, keen-edged like a rapier. In the meantime, he was conscious of Sir James's close scrutiny. When the lawyer dropped his eyes, the young man had the feeling that the other had read him through and through like an open book. He could not but wonder what the final judgment was, but there was little chance of learning that. Sir James took in everything, but gave out only what he chose. A proof of that occurred almost at once. Immediately the first greetings were over, Julius broke out into a flood of eager questions. How had Sir James managed to track the girl? Why had he not let them know that he was still working on the case? And so on. Sir James stroked his chin and smiled. At last he said,
"Just so, just so. Well, she's found, and that's the great thing, isn't it? Eh? Come now, that's the great thing."
"Sure it is. But just how did you strike her trail? Miss Tuppence and I thought you'd quit for good and all."
"Ah!"
The lawyer shot a lightning glance at him, then resumed operations on his chin.
"You thought that, did you? Did you really? Dear me."
"But I guess I can take it we were wrong," pursued Julius.
"Well, I don't know that I should go so far as to say that, but it's certainly fortunate for all parties that we've managed to find the young lady."
"But where is she?" demanded Julius, his thoughts flying off on another tack. "I thought you'd be sure to bring her along."
"That would hardly be possible," said Sir James gravely.
"Why?"
"Because the young lady was knocked down in a street accident and has sustained slight injuries to the head. She was taken to the infirmary, and on recovering consciousness gave her name as Jane Finn. When I heard that, I arranged for her to be removed to the house of a doctor, a friend of mine, and wired at once for you. She relapsed into unconsciousness and has not spoken since."
"She's not seriously hurt?"
"Oh, a bruise and a cut or two. Really, from a medical point of view, absurdly slight injuries to have produced such a condition. Her state is probably to be attributed to the mental shock consequent on recovering her memory."
"It's come back?" cried Julius excitedly. Sir James tapped the table rather impatiently.
"Undoubtedly, Mr. Hirschheimer, since she was able to give her real name, I thought you had appreciated that point."
"And you just happened to be on the spot," said Tommy. "Seems quite like a fairy tale."
But Sir James was far too wary to be drawn. "Coincidences are curious things," he said dryly.
Nevertheless, Tommy was now certain of what he had before only suspected. Sir James's presence in Manchester was not accidental. Far from abandoning the case, as Julius supposed, he had, by some means of his own, successfully run the missing girl to earth. The only thing that puzzled Tommy was the reason for all this secrecy. He concluded that it was a foible of the legal mind. Julius was speaking.
"After dinner," he announced, "I shall go right away and see Jane."
"That will be impossible, I fear," said Sir James. "It is very unlikely they would allow her to see visitors at this time of night. I should suggest tomorrow morning about 10 o'clock.
Julius flushed. There was something in Sir James which always stirred him to antagonism. It was conflict of two masterful personalities.
All the same, I reckon I'll go round there tonight and see if I can't ginger them up to break through those silly rules.
It will be quite useless, Mr. Herrsheimer.
The words came out like the crack of a pistol, and Tommy looked up with a start. Julius was nervous and excited. The hand with which he raised his glass to his lips shook slightly, but his eyes held Sir James's defiantly. For a moment the hostility between the two seemed likely to burst into flame, but in the end Julius lowered his eyes, defeated.
"For the moment I reckon you're the boss."
"Thank you," said the other. "We will say 10 o'clock, then."
With consummate ease of manner he turned to Tommy.
"I must confess, Mr. Beresford, that it was something of a surprise to me to see you here this evening. The last I heard of you was that your friends were in grave anxiety on your behalf. Nothing had been heard of you for some days, and Miss Tuppence was inclined to think you had got into difficulties."
"I had, sir."
Tommy grinned reminiscently.
"I was never in a tighter place in my life."
Helped out by questions from Sir James, he gave an abbreviated account of his adventures. The lawyer looked at him with renewed interest as he brought the tale to a close.
"You got yourself out of a tight place very well," he said gravely. "I congratulate you. You displayed a great deal of ingenuity and carried your part through well."
Tommy blushed, his face assuming a prawn-like hue at the praise.
"I couldn't have got away but for the girl, sir."
"No," Sir James smiled a little. "It was lucky for you she happened to, take a fancy to you."
Tommy appeared about to protest, but Sir James went on, "There's no doubt about her being one of the gang, I suppose."
"I'm afraid not, sir. I thought perhaps they were keeping her there by force, but the way she acted didn't fit in with that. You see, she went back to them when she could have got away."
Sir James nodded thoughtfully.
"What did she say? Something about wanting to be taken to Marguerite?"
"Yes, sir. I suppose she meant Mrs. Vandermeer."
"She always signed herself Rita Vandermeer. All her friends spoke of her as Rita. Still, I suppose the girl must have been in the habit of calling her by her full name. And at the moment she was crying out to her, Mrs. Vandermeer was either dead or dying.
Curious.
There are one or two points that strike me as being obscure. Their sudden change of attitude towards yourself, for instance. By the way, the house was raided, of course."
"Yes, sir, but they'd all cleared out."
"Naturally," said Sir James dryly.
"And not a clue left behind."
"I wonder."
The lawyer tapped the table thoughtfully. Something in his voice made Tommy look up. Would this man's eyes have seen something where theirs had been blind? He spoke impulsively.
"I wish you'd been there, sir, to go over the house."
"I wish I had," said Sir James quietly.
He sat for a moment in silence, then he looked up.
"And since then, what have you been doing?"
For a moment Tommy stared at him. Then it dawned on him that, of course, the lawyer did not know.
"I forgot that you didn't know about Tuppence," he said slowly.
The sickening anxiety, forgotten for a while in the excitement of knowing Jane Finn was found at last, swept over him again. The lawyer laid down his knife and fork sharply.
"Has anything happened to Miss Tuppence?"
His voice was keen-edged.
"She's disappeared," said Julius.
"When?"
"A week ago." "How?"
Sir James's questions fairly shot out.
Between them, Tommy and Julius gave the history of the last week and their futile search.
Sir James went at once to the root of the matter.
"A wire signed with your name. They knew enough of you both for that. They weren't sure of how much you had learnt in that house. Their kidnapping of Miss Tuppence is the countermove to your escape. If necessary, they could seal your lips with a threat of what might happen to her."
Tommy nodded.
"That's just what I thought, sir."
Sir James looked at him keenly.
"You had worked that out, had you? Not bad, not at all bad. The curious thing is that they certainly did not know anything about you when they first held you prisoner.
"'You're sure that you did not in any way disclose your identity?'
Tommy shook his head.
"'That's so,' said Julius with a nod. "'Therefore I reckon someone put them wise, and not earlier than Sunday afternoon.'
"'Yes, but who?'
"'That almighty omniscient Mr. Brown, of course.'
There was a faint note of derision in the American's voice, which made Sir James look up sharply.
"'You don't believe in Mr. Brown, Mr. Hersheimer?'
"'No, sir, I do not.' returned the young American with emphasis.
"'Not as such, that is to say. I reckon it out that he's a figurehead, just a bogey name to frighten the children with. The real head of this business is that Russian chap, Kramanin. I guess he's quite capable of running revolutions in three countries at once if he chose. The man Whittington is probably the head of the English branch.'
"'I disagree with you,' said Sir James shortly. "'Mr. Brown exists.'
He turned to Tommy.
"'Did you happen to notice where that wire was handed in?'
"'No, sir, I'm afraid I didn't.'
"'Hmm. Got it with you?'
"'It's upstairs, sir, in my kit.'
"'I'd like to have a look at it sometime. No hurry. You've wasted a week.'
Tommy hung his head.
"'A day or so more is immaterial. We'll deal with Miss Jane Finn first. Afterwards we'll set to work to rescue Miss Tuppence from bondage. I don't think she's in any immediate danger.' That is, so long as they don't know that we've got Jane Finn, and that her memory has returned. We must keep that dark at all costs. You understand?
The other two assented, and after making arrangements for meeting on the morrow, the great lawyer took his leave. At 10 o'clock, the two young men were at the appointed spot. Sir James had joined them on the doorstep. He alone appeared unexcited. He introduced them to the doctor.
"'Mr. Hersheimer, Mr. Beresford, Dr. Roylance. How's the patient?'
"'Going on well. Evidently no idea of the flight of time. Asked this morning how many had been saved from the Lusitania. Was it in the papers yet? That, of course, was only what was to be expected. She seems to have something on her mind, though. I think we can relieve her anxiety. May we go up?'
"'Certainly.'
Tommy's heart beat sensibly faster as they followed the doctor upstairs. Jane Finn, at last! The long-sought, the mysterious, the elusive Jane Finn! How wildly improbable success had seemed! And here in this house, her memory almost miraculously restored, lay the girl who held the future of England in her hands. A half-groan broke from Tommy's lips. If only Tuppence could have been at his side to share in the triumphant conclusion of their joint venture! Then he put the thought of Tuppence resolutely aside. His confidence in Sir James was growing. There was a man who would unerringly ferret out Tuppence's whereabouts. In the meantime, Jane Finn! And suddenly a dread clutched at his heart. It seemed too easy. Suppose they should find her dead, stricken down by the hand of Mr. Brown! In another minute he was laughing at these melodramatic fancies. The doctor held open the door of a room, and they passed in. On the white bed, bandages round her head, lay the girl. Somehow the whole scene seemed unreal. It was so exactly what one expected that it gave the effect of being beautifully staged. The girl looked from one to the other of them with large, wondering eyes. Sir James spoke first.
"'Miss Finn?' he said. "'This is your cousin, Mr. Julius P. Hersheimer.'
A faint flush flitted over the girl's face as Julius stepped forward and took her hand.
"'How do, Cousin Jane?' he said lightly.
But Tommy caught the tremor in his voice.
"'Are you really Uncle Hiram's son?' she asked wonderingly.
Her voice, with the slight warmth of the Western accent, had an almost thrilling quality. It seemed vaguely familiar to Tommy, but he thrust the impression aside as impossible.
"'Sure thing!'
"'We used to read about Uncle Hiram in the papers,' continued the girl in her low, soft tones. "'But I never thought I'd meet you one day. Mother figured it out that Uncle Hiram would never get over being mad with her.'
"'The old man was like that,' admitted Julius. "'But I guess the new generation's sort of different. Got no use for the family feud business. First thing I thought about soon as the war was over was to come along and hunt you up.
A shadow passed over the girl's face. They've been telling me things, dreadful things, that my memory went, and that there are years I shall never know about, years lost out of my life.
You didn't realize that yourself?
The girl's eyes opened wide. Why, no. It seems to me as though it were no time since we were being hustled into those boats. I can see it all now.
She closed her eyes with a shudder.
Julius looked across at Sir James, who nodded.
"Don't worry, Annie. It isn't worth it. Now, see here, Jane, there is something we want to know about. There was a man aboard that boat with some mighty important papers on him, and the big guns in this country have got a notion that he passed on the goods to you. Is that so?"
The girl hesitated, her glance shifting to the other two. Julius understood.
"Mr. Beresford is commissioned by the British government to get those papers back. Sir James Peel Edgerton is an English Member of Parliament, and might be a big gun in the Cabinet if he liked. It's owing to him that we've ferreted you out at last. So you can go right ahead and tell us the whole story. Did Danvers give you the papers?"
"Yes. He said they'd have a better chance with me, because they would save the women and children first."
"Just as we thought," said Sir James.
"He said they were very important. They might make all the difference to the Allies. If it's all so long ago and the war's over, what does it matter now?"
"I guess history repeats itself, Jane. First there was a great hue and cry over those papers, and it all died down, and now the whole caboodle started all over again, for rather different reasons. Then you can hand them over to us right away?"
"But I can't."
"What?"
"I haven't got them."
"You haven't got them?"
Julius punctuated the words with little pauses. "No, I hid them."
"You hid them?"
"Yes, I got uneasy. People seemed to be watching me. It scared me badly." She put her hand to her head. "It's almost the last thing I remember before waking up in the hospital."
"Go on," said Sir James in his quiet, penetrating tones. "What do you remember?"
She turned to him obediently. "It was at Holyhead. I came that way. I don't remember why."
"That doesn't matter. Go on."
"In the confusion on the quay, I slipped away. Nobody saw me. I took a car, told the man to drive me out of the town. I watched when we got on the open road. No other car was following us. I saw a path at the side of the road. I told the man to wait." She paused, then went on. "The path led to the cliff and down to the sea, between big yellow gorse bushes. They were like golden flames. I looked round, there wasn't a soul in sight, but just level with my head there was a hole in the rock. It was quite small, I could only just get my hand in, but it went a long way back. I took the oilskin packet from round my neck and shoved it right in as far as I could. Then I tore off a bit of gorse, my, but it did prick, and plugged the hole with it so that you'd never guess there was a crevice of any kind there. And I marked the place carefully in my own mind, so that I'd find it again. There was a queer boulder in the path just there, for all the world like a dog sitting up begging. Then I went back to the road. The car was waiting, and I drove back. I just caught the train. I was a bit ashamed of myself for fancying things, maybe, but by and by I saw the man opposite me wink at a woman who was sitting next to me, and I felt scared again and was glad the papers were safe. I went out in the corridor to get a little air. I thought I'd slip into another carriage. But the woman called me back, said I'd dropped something, and when I stooped to look, something seemed to hit me. Here." She placed her hand to the back of her head. "I don't remember anything more until I woke up in the hospital." There was a pause.
"Thank you, Miss Finn."
It was Sir James who spoke.
"I hope we have not tired you."
"Oh, that's all right. My head aches a little, but otherwise I feel fine." Julius stepped forward and took her hand again.
"So long, Cousin Jane. I'm going to get busy after those papers, but I'll be back in two shakes of a dog's tail, and I'll tote you up to London and give you the time of your young life before we go back to the States. I mean it. So hurry up and get well."